This is Janine Spurgeon, and today is January 28th, 2021, and I'm speaking with Shariq Siddiqui, who is a Plainfield resident. He is an assistant professor, and we're going to talk to him about his experience during the COVID-19 pandemic. Hello, Shariq.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
Great. Well, let's just jump in there, and I'll start with the first question. When you first heard about the virus way back when it started, what were your thoughts about it?
So I didn't take it as seriously as other people. I thought this is something happening in another part of the world, and it won't affect us. Mm-hmm. And so actually when the day that the pandemic was announced and, you know, things started closing down, I was actually in Chicago for a week-long series of lectures. You know, I was social distancing while I was in Chicago. I had a face mask, and I was staying in my hotel and just going to my lecture and then coming back. I arrived there on Friday, and on Monday, the governor in Illinois said that he was closing down restaurants. And at that point, I knew I couldn't eat. So then I just took the flight home on Monday, and I've been home since then.
Was that in March then?
It was in March,
okay.
Yes.
Have you changed your opinion of the seriousness?
Yeah, I think it's become, I quickly realized how serious it was once I came home, and I think I started hearing more and sort of tuning in. And since then, I've basically has tried to stay home as much as possible, having to go out, or at least I go out only when I have to, mm-hmm. Just because I think it has been pretty dramatic in terms of how it's impacted our country and right. The world, actually.
What issues concerned you most about the virus?
I think the first thing is I was just worried that someone in my family or I would get sick. A few of us have, additional causes. Like I have some healthcare issues mm-hmm. that could be exacerbated. So I think that was the primary concern. So you start out with just thinking about people getting sick. Mm-hmm. I think the second piece was that how this is going to impact employment, right? Because right. my family relies on me mm-hmm. to provide for them, and I was worried about that. And then I guess the third piece of it was I was worried about my children's education. They're in different places at different times. And once I thought of that, I was thinking about everybody else around me, right? I'm privileged. I'm a university, so we're a little better off in terms of mitigating the challenges of COVID, but there are people that can't. I can teach online. But a lot of people have to go into work and just worried about people around me. Yeah. So I think that, and then ultimately I just was worried about how politicized it eventually became. And sadly, that made it worse. So, all of that. And then I have family all over the world, from Pakistan to England to Australia. And it's been isolating and stressful thinking about all of that.
Has the pandemic affected your job at all at this point?
So luckily, I haven't been unemployed, and I'm an assistant professor, and I continue to teach. My research projects are going well. So I think from that point of view, it hasn't impacted me in the sense that for the given future, provided I do my job, I'm going to have a job. So I'm lucky
right.
in that regard. I think the one thing that we know is that, and we're more privileged than most people. But we've been told that we're not going to be getting raises for the next foreseeable futures. But I think at the same time, costs continue to go up. So in essence, you're taking a step back. But I think from that perspective, I'm still in a good place.
Right.
I can teach online. I teach on Zoom, and I teach asynchronous, all that. So from that perspective, it's going well. My research has been impacted because a lot of my research is qualitative. I actually do things like similar to what you're doing, mm-hmm. which is talk to people, interview with them. And some of my projects are sustained periods. So just for being sustained periods of time where the only contact these people that I'm studying are only seeing me by phone or by Zoom, mm-hmm. It doesn't create the same level of connections that ethnographic research is strong. And so there's some challenges with that as well.
Has the pandemic affected the employment of anyone you know?
I don't think anybody has had good experience in terms of many of the people that I know, they have been able to sustain what they're doing. But I know quite a few people who are business owners or who are in jobs that require going in. And those jobs have resulted in furloughs, in business, you know, in some of my friends, their business is down to zero. So they're living on savings. Another person I know basically spent all of year not earning anything at all. My brother, for example, his income went to zero, and he basically has racked up debt. And, you know, once they went through their savings. And then I've seen people who have to do voluntary pay cuts. So there have been others. Luckily, not me, but a lot of people around me are in that boat.
And how has COVID-19 affected you and or your family's day-to-day activities?
I think in the beginning, it was where we were all isolated. So we were doing e-learning, just like everybody else. And so then this year, it's been, from my perspective, I work from home. So I get up and I go to my computer and I work all day. One personal impact that it's happened is that there was a time when you used to go to work. So I would go to university and I would come back. And then the other times were kind of recognized as being personal time. But now I could be working starting as early as 7 and then going until 10, 11, or even midnight. So the boundaries of I tend to be, you know, while I'm at home, just because I think there's expectations are that you're doing all this stuff and there's an anxiety, you just want to make sure you perform more so that, you know, so that you're seen as valuable. So those boundaries have gone for my personal. So that's one piece. Mm-hmm. I think for my oldest daughter, last year she finished law school, so she couldn't go to her law school graduation. But then beyond that, she was in the last few months of an internship in Washington, D.C. in immigration law. And basically her landlord had told her she had to leave because they wanted to give that space to some relative of theirs that was losing their place. So she had to come back home, and so she had to finish that up, and that was a different experience for her. And she's been studying for the bar exam, which has been really difficult during this period of time because the bar exam format has changed from written to so on. So she's been navigating those issues. Mm-hmm. My son was in his second semester at DePaul, and he was all excited to have left home, right? freedom. And then, you know, for March, he comes straight back, and he's been living at home since then.
Oh,
and his entire sophomore year is at home.
Oh.
So that's been tough on him. And then I have a senior and a middle schooler. And their case, they did e-learning, but then we were very nervous about sending them back. But the problem was that within the school system, they're both in advanced courses. And so they had a choice between just giving up advanced courses and then being able to do e-learning or do advanced courses and show up to class. So it was really tough. We sent them to school. And in essence, our schedule is we get up, they go to school, my wife goes to work, and then they come back and we're all at home. We don't go anywhere. We're spending a lot more time with each other, but mm-hmm. I think that's probably joyful for the parents and not so joyful for the kids, right?
Now, I haven't had any kids that I've spoken to have any negative things to say about that, surprisingly so.
That's good. Wait till you talk to mine. We adopted a Siberian Husky, and I think because of COVID, we could spend a lot more time with her.
Mm-hmm.
But then in addition to that, I really added vegetable beds to my house. So I had 3 and I added 3 more, so I have 6. And so we did a lot of vegetable gardening. We built a patio in the back with the help of my sons. I mean, they're probably regretting it all. So we did a lot of outdoor work. We planted trees and did that. So we did a lot of that. And I think the other thing is we did get to check out a lot of Hendricks County's trails that we hadn't seen before. We went out there, went to the trails, went to different parks, you know, state parks and county parks, and so we would routinely take our puppy. And so it was really nice in the spring, the summer, and the fall.
Mm-hmm.
The winter, we've been cooped up. I think the winter is tougher than it was.
Yeah.
I think spring will be nice again.
Has the outbreak affected how you associate, communicate with your, you've got a large network of friends and family. Has it affected how you communicate with them?
Yeah, it has. In the beginning, there was this really conscious effort that we need to stay in contact. There's a poetry group in Hendricks County
mm-hmm.
that me and a few friends, we used to come together and we would host them in our basement. And so what we started doing was we created a WhatsApp group
uh-huh.
so that we could stay connected. So that was one. And then I organized a few Zoom calls where everybody connected, and we did poetry readings. And then, you know, for example, every 4 years since, for the past 20, 30 years, we've had an election night party where we have friends over and we watch election returns, and my kids have posters and they draw, and we have our own election center that we do. So this year we did that all on Zoom. So there's that. Same with family, you know, we have WhatsApp groups, we have Zoom calls. Have tried to do that, but I think, but over time, especially in the fall when people got really, really busy, mm-hmm. I think the spring, there was hope that this would at some point end in the summer, and then during the summer, that hope evaporated. Mm-hmm. And by fall, I felt, at least the feeling I got was everybody has now entered into survival mode. Mm-hmm. And so all those innovations went by the wayside. So now we talk on the phone every now and then, we'll text each other. Mm-hmm. But by and large, I would say on the personal side, I'm totally isolated, you know, in terms of friends. And then I talk to my family routinely. Right. I have a sister in Australia, a sister in England, parents in England, brother in Dubai, a brother in Japan who's now moved to England. So those people, you know, almost routinely I'll talk to over the phone. But I used to do that beforehand, so that hasn't changed. In fact, the only difference is when I used to go to work every morning, the 30 minutes it takes me to go to IUPUI, I would call my parents in the morning. So I would speak to them half an hour in the morning, and then I would speak with them on the drive back. And that's become lesser so because I don't have that dead time. All that dead time is filled with work.
So have you been able to carve out any personal time for yourself?
Not as much as one would hope. I think in the summer more so by doing these projects together mm-hmm. and so on. But really, these days, the day starts and you have a lot of work to do. Academics are focused on writing, and so we're trying to get a lot of writing done. And then that goes into the evening. We're watching more TV than I would probably like. So that seems to be the form of entertainment that has been predominant, I guess, at this stage. I did buy a pizza oven, and I bought a tandoor. So I've been cooking a lot for my kids, and I've been cooking pizza dough. I make pizza dough from scratch. I make the sauces from scratch. So a lot of pizza making, a lot of cooking. So that lot of, and the kids have loved that.
You were mentioning how your emotions changed as this went on, how you were scared and then you were hopeful and then your hopes were dashed. How do you feel now about the fact that there's a vaccine out? Are you guys starting to see a light at the end of the tunnel?
Yeah. Honestly speaking, I think one, the vaccine coming out was a big boost. And I'll be honest, the election change in the White House mm-hmm. was the second piece because I wasn't sure what this would mean, the politicization of the vaccine, how that would go, mm-hmm. how I think one of the confusing pieces was that it wasn't really felt, or at least I felt that it wasn't taken seriously at the top.
Right.
And so the new president and with the administration really talking about this, taking it seriously, and some would argue going too seriously, but I think I feel better. And I keep telling my kids, even though Indiana is facing these huge shortages of vaccine, and not only us, everybody in the world is. My parents are in England. My dad has his first shot, but he doesn't know when he's going to get a second one. But in my mind, I keep thinking, let's hope by the end of summer we're all vaccinated, and then that's good. Now, from my perspective, that's fine, right? Because mm-hmm. I've already thought about my work for the summer, fall and the spring and the summer. But for kids, that's an eternity, right, to think about that. And then Zaki doesn't get to get vaccinated because he's under 16. So he's like all bummed out because his life won't change, right? You know, I just feel bad because these kids, you know, in my case, I'm 49. I'll be 50 this year. My life is very much about my family. I've had the opportunity to have childhood friends. I've had the high school friends, I've had the college friends, right? But, you know, for kids, their social life is so important, right? Yes. Overly important. Mm-hmm. And this is extraordinarily difficult for them. And I think in scale of things, like, you know, there are people dying all over the world, right? And I get that we're much more privileged than everybody else. Mm-hmm. But still, their lives are impacted. And, you know, you wonder what that's going to be. So I'm hopeful. I just worry about I think this pandemic is changing us worldwide and in this country. And what I worry is I don't know what this final piece will look like economically. I'm talking from higher ed to public education mm-hmm. to jobs. What I worry is that I'm glad that the pandemic hopefully will get it behind us. There are these mutant strains, and I'm praying that the scientists are going to be on top of it. And just like our flu vaccine gets updated and changed, mm-hmm. this will be a thing here. I believe enough in, you know, that the public will to do that. What we don't know is that the same way, like, the information age came in the 90s, and it just decimated our economy, right, in terms of manufacturing and so on. So my worry is that this pandemic is about to decimate a whole different group of people. At some point, people will say, you know what, we don't really need professors to this many. We'll just do, you know, we don't need to have these big universities with these research centers. We don't need libraries. You know, we can get e-books and those things out. And I just worry that COVID has made life possible without people physically being at different places.
Yes.
And in a very market-driven economy, I worry what that means for us going forward. And I don't know the answer. I just am nervous about it.
How do you feel the playing field community in general has responded to the pandemic? Do you think we've responded well or badly, or how?
I mean, I think our institutions have done somewhat better than, I think, other institutions. So, for example, the Aquatic Center has been very good and very responsible. I think the library has. I think the school has, for the most part, initially I was nervous about their decision to come back, but the numbers have borne them out. So, I give them a lot of credit in terms of, I think they surprised me. So, I think in that regard, I think the institutions have done well. I think people have not. I think when I go for grocery shopping, I see people there. I remember going to Menards to pick up something, and I had people arguing with the security people there about not wanting to wear masks. Even when you're walking outside, people are, you know, you go to Hummel Park, people aren't wearing masks. So I think people have not been very good. Like I was telling you, we would go out a lot on trails, but we were forced to keep finding trails that were more and more isolated because people didn't follow the rules. But if everybody followed the rules, then we could all make life. I think people have not been good in Plainfield, I would argue. And a friend of mine moved from Seattle, Washington, to Indiana. We hired him, and he moved in the fall. And he was in for a huge culture shock because he felt that he actually has gone back there, Seattle, because we're all online, so he can work from anywhere. Mm-hmm. But he felt that Plainfield was not a very civic-minded community, is what he thought it was. His point. He said, "You guys aren't very civic-minded." And I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "You guys don't seem to care about other people in Seattle. People are voluntarily going in and getting tested. Nobody's out there without masks. People are still going out on the trails. They're making life happen, but they're doing it in such a responsible way. We're civic obligations to each other." He said Indiana doesn't seem to have civic mindedness. Doesn't seem to be anybody cares about any obligations to anybody else. He's planning to settle here and all that stuff. But I thought that was surprising because I was frustrated by what I saw. But I always thought Hoosiers were civic-minded people, right?
But maybe we're wrong. Yeah.
Yeah, at least from that was his perspective, right? Coming from Seattle, where it was a different, you know, he felt safer there, right? And actually, he went back there because he has these serious health issues, and he felt in danger here. So he's in Seattle because he feels, you know,
that is very striking.
I'm safer.
You and your family are Muslim Americans. How do you think the Muslim American community has been handling this? Any different than, you know, the general population?
So for Muslim Americans, there are two or three major crises that have occurred, and we've handled it in a mixed way. I think one is that the pandemic came about a month before Ramadan. So March is when the pandemic hit. And in April, we had Ramadan. And Ramadan is the holy month where we fast from sunup to sundown. But it's also the month where we are highly social. So every night you have congregational prayers at the mosque where people gather, and they go till late into the night. Ramadan is also the month where you have most Muslim nonprofit organizations raise most of their money for the year. So Muslims give most of their money during Ramadan. And they're usually done at events through these congregational prayers or through fundraising dinners. And so when this initially happened, there was this great deal of anxiety, and actually mosques have suffered as a result of that, these places of worship, because if people aren't coming, people are a creature of habit, then they're not giving, right? So to the mosques. It doesn't mean they're not giving. These humanitarian organizations, food aid, all these organizations that are digitally active, and that's where you're used to giving to them, actually have raised more than they've ever raised before. So I think institutionally, there's this kind of a segregation, right? So I think there's that piece. The other piece of it is that I think that there's been this uncertainty both at the federal level but also the state level in terms of what it means to get together, then exemption of religious places. So Indianapolis Muslim community actually created a task force that included scientists, you know, people that worked at Lilly and public health officials and others and religious leaders to come up with a, because we have to pray Friday in congregation. And so that group actually then basically started taking the lead. So whereas I felt that state government and federal government wasn't willing to take the bold decisions about congregations and so on, this group did. But over time, the Muslim Hoosiers are no different than any other Hoosiers, right? So now we are seeing more prayers in the mosque and so on. So I think there's that piece to it. I think the other challenge that Muslims have faced is that they've been under attack and scrutiny for so long. Mm-hmm. And then when George Floyd's murder took place, I think that really sort of hit home for many people, because I think there's been a lot of collective trauma that the community is dealing with that they don't feel that they can express because they don't have the traditional means of being in a congregation to connect and sort of to engage. So it's been stressful in that regard. But I've been really impressed by that they created something called the Muslim Task Force and its work in trying to sort of create connections between those that need with those that have has been really impressive.
What did you guys do? Did you gather, or did you Zoom, or how did you guys gather, you know, when we were all locked down?
We didn't. Basically, in my home, most families, what we started doing is on Friday we do congregational prayers. So we took turns. So I would take one day, Zaki did one day, Safa did one day. So each one of us took a day every Friday and we do congregational prayers until school started. But because congregational prayers fall during the times that they're at school, so a lot of homes did congregational prayers at home, and so did we. And that happened across, you know, when we had Eid al-Fitr, which is, you know, our Christmas, and then Eid al-Adha, which is our other Christmas. Same thing. We just did those events at home. These are highly social events. So people did not. They stayed apart. And I do know that a few Muslim families that I talked to did some really interesting things where they put chairs and tables 10 feet apart in their backyards. And people came and basically were able to sort of be apart but wear masks and be outside and so on. So there were some of those innovations that, you know, everybody did. But no, this was one of the toughest Ramadans. And this coming one probably is going to be the same, because I don't think we'll be vaccinated by April.
Have you known anybody that's gotten sick?
Quite a few people have gotten sick. A few have died, sadly. The Imam in Indianapolis, Imam Ahmed Al-Amin, who's very active, very socially engaged, was right, you know, the heart of the Muslim Task Force, got sick and was in the hospital for a long time. Quite a few people within the broader community. And then I do research on Muslim nonprofits and Muslim nonprofit leaders. So within that group, one of the people that I'm studying, her husband passed away just last week. Many Muslims happen to, if you think about Muslims in America, they're only 1% of the population, but they represent 5% of the healthcare workers, right? So doctors, nurses, physicians.
Yeah.
If you were to think about places like New York, Michigan, Chicago, essential workers represent, you know, the Muslim may be a population of 1 to 2%, but 8 to 10% of essential workers are Muslim. And we're such a small community. So these people are getting sick in large numbers. Now, of course, I have a friend of mine who he got sick, his entire family got sick. And as a result, they've been, you know, they no longer socially isolate. They're traveling. They're doing the stuff that they want to do. So I have quite a few. My brother, my sister-in-law got COVID. She's in Florida. She's a physician. So a lot of these people are at the front lines, and many of them. And the challenge is that some of these doctors are older. They're still practicing in 60s or 70s, and many of them have succumbed to and have passed away as a result.
Usually, it seems like when I ask most people if they've known anybody gotten sick, they mostly say, well, yeah, I know a couple, but they all got better. This is, your story is actually worse than anybody's.
I think it's because the demographics. I think if you were to speak to more people of color, for example, and I'm not saying that you haven't, but I think that people of color have been disproportionately affected by this. Mm-hmm. And then in the Muslim community, it just so happens that my network largely is that group of people that are physicians and all that kind of stuff. So like one of the groups that I'm studying is the American Muslim Health Professionals. Uh-huh. And then the other one is the Islamic Medical Association. So all groups of doctors and so on. So that's one of the reasons. But in Indianapolis, we've seen more COVID. One of our close friends who is on the south side of Indianapolis, she got COVID and she was social isolating and so on, all that kind of stuff, right? But she couldn't figure out how she got it. So we've had people that have gotten sick and gotten better. We know people that got sick and are still dealing with it like months later. And then we have people that have died.
Do you know anybody who's gotten it twice?
No, I have not.
What are your primary sources of news?
I used to joke, I used to watch The Daily Show, and that was that was the comedy shows were my source of news. But, you know, of course, I try to listen to CNN just because I think, and I listen to evening news, right? And that's another important piece. I stay away from Fox News and MSNBC just because I feel they're skewed. We listen to ABC, Nightly News, NBC, Nightly, and CBS, those kinds of, but stay away from those other channels. Got a lot of news through colleagues of mine that are sharing on social media, and that can be problematic because sometimes these sources are just, you don't know where they're coming from.
Right.
I've kind of figured out that slant that Washington Post, New York Times, and Wall Street Journal take. And so those are some other places. So much more traditional forms of news, as it were.
Do you think that you're getting different information depending on your source of news about this
Absolutely.
Pandemic? Yeah. And do you
Absolutely.
Think it affects how the community acts?
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. I don't watch Fox News, but I try to go on there just to see how they're conveying. I want to know what everybody else around me is consuming because I want to live in this society, right? So I go to Fox News just to learn, and it's very different. And when I go to MSNBC, because I have friends that are on the far left, and I want to know what they're, because I think if I don't have those realities, it's hard for me to engage with them, right? And I want to engage with them.
Mm-hmm.
So I can tell you just the same news story on Fox News versus on MSNBC and CNN are totally different,
yes.
right? And it's very sad how these alternate realities, and there is very little of true news or true journalism on television. NPR is probably the one place that I feel, NPR is on all the time at our house. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's on too much because, all day long, the radio is on. So that's probably the number one source of news. And it's very different than what you hear. Even on CNN, CNN, I listen to it just because it's marginally better than Fox. Not marginally, it's much better than Fox and MSNBC. But they still have an opinion, right?
Correct,
and it's still built to drive ratings.
Knowing what you know now, what do you think individuals, communities, or governments need to keep in mind for the future? What is your biggest takeaway from this?
I think that we have to figure out a way to find a bipartisan group of rational people that are willing to take the center of the conversation. And I think the idea that this public health is dependent on who's in government and what political interest there is of theirs to do this. And it's not about party. Honestly, what we are suffering from is the industrial political partisan complex. There are political operatives on both sides of the aisle that make money through division and by sustaining these realities. And it's true for Democrats, it's true for Republicans. But I think what we really need is a group of people that are above this all, that can sort of be able, almost like the Fed. We need a Fed for such healthcare emergencies or crises because our other institutions are not working. But the Fed has worked. For better or for worse, we have this sustained period of economic growth, good or bad, and I can see the inequality that exists. But the Fed has worked, and we need something like that that's above this all. It's not a crazy idea, right? If you like, I've lived all over the world before I came to the United States. In the world, when you talk to my parents, you talk to my uncles and relatives and friends overseas, they'll say it doesn't matter who's in political power. It's the bureaucracy in America that decides policy, right? And we are suffering because of that. So, you know, it's not this insane idea that policy over time has been shaped by bureaucrats, right?
That is the end of my questions. I'm going to have to say this is the best interview I've done so far.
Oh, thank you.
Very informative, really enlightening. I really, really appreciate your participation in this.
I wanted to thank you for including the Muslim community. I mean, I appreciate you wanting to be inclusive. And, you know, it's, what's interesting is the Muslim community of Plainfield in Hendricks County is kind of a very unique, special community within greater Indianapolis. I mean, for example, if you think about it, in the last 10 to 15 years, 5 to 7 valedictorians have been Muslim. What's interesting is in Carmel, you don't see that, right?
Oh.
There's been one valedictorian in Carmel, and there's more Muslims there. This community has created leaders, right?
Uh-huh.
So if you were to think about statewide and national organizations, many people have been from here. If you think about our kids, they're out there in interfaith activities, raising money, doing those activities. And so a lot of people have asked, even in the Muslim community in other parts of town, one is they say is that the Plainfield Avon Muslim community is a very cohesive community. And I think that comes because we're small.
Uh-huh.
I think the second thing comes out is that they're very civically engaged. I think the third is we've had a few successes. And then that's allowed more successes to take place. It's incredible. I mean, one family in Plainfield, their oldest son, Saleh, was a valedictorian. Their daughter, Sidra, was valedictorian. Their third child, Salik, is, I think they've already finalized it, but either valedictorian or salutatorian this year. Of the top two kids, they're actually cousins. One is Rashad Saleem, who, and then the other one is Salik, and they're cousins. So on. And so there's that, and then the Hattabs, and then the others, and so on. So it's just, it's interesting. So it's not even, you know, one is has been an Arab, one has been Indian, one's been Pakistani, like different. So it's, I don't know what it is, but it's kind of cool.
It really is. Thank you once again, and I will let you get on with your day, and I hope it's a good one.